In 1854, there was an outbreak of cholera in London. Many of you probably know the story. Dr. John Snow, now credited as the father of epidemiology, determined that the cause of the outbreak was contaminated water coming from a pump on Broad Street. Dr. Snow and the Board of Guardians of St. James Parish, where the pump was located, removed the handle from the pump and the outbreak ended. Of course, we aren't talking about cholera epidemics today, we are talking about Genesis, where Joseph is still ruling Egypt and posing as an Egyptian, and he has planted evidence and falsely accused Benjamin of stealing. He has told the brothers that he will keep Benjamin as a servant and send them back to Israel without him. Judah, however, has demonstrated real contrition for the error of selling Joseph into slavery and has offered up himself to ensure that Benjamin goes home. Today, we will come to the shocking conclusion, and we will learn a little about God's plan for our lives, and particularly about the value of distinction. We'll be reading from Genesis chapters 45 and 46, and a little bit into 47, so you can go ahead and read that on your own. Now, on seeing Judah's penitent attitude, Joseph is overwhelmed with emotion. We have seen him overwhelmed in such a way before. First, when the brothers displayed their guilt at having sold him into slavery, and second, when he saw Benjamin again. In those instances, Joseph went to another room to weep so that his identity would not be made known. In this case, Joseph has decided to go ahead and reveal his true identity. He orders his servants to leave so that he is alone with the brothers, and he weeps so loudly that the Egyptians and even Pharaoh's house hear it. And then Joseph reveals himself. The sons of Israel, on hearing that the Egyptian ruler is actually their long-lost brother, are reasonably shocked and I suppose are afraid for their lives. If there's anyone in the world that they would expect to kill them in vengeance, it's Joseph. And if there's anyone in the world who has the power to do so, Joseph is the one. So the brothers are very much afraid. Joseph, however, explains the story to them. He says that he is in fact the Joseph whom they sold into slavery, and tells them about how he has risen up from his lowly condition to become like a father to Pharaoh and a ruler in Egypt. Joseph emphasizes that these things were all accomplished by divine providence. The famine, he explains, will go on for another 5 years, and in light of this, Joseph explains that God sent him to Egypt to save the world and preserve his brothers. For that reason, Joseph urges his brothers not to be distressed or angry with themselves for their wrongdoing. Now, we have already discussed God's plan in relation to Joseph, so I won't overemphasize the point here, but I do think it is worth noting that in the end, Joseph believes this has all been for the best. Our lives are often full of suffering and unexpected problems. But if we trust in God, then in the end, we will ultimately find that it all works out for our best interest. God's plan is larger and more complex than anything we can comprehend. He has predetermined the whole of every life from the beginning of creation. All of those lives will have suffering, and some of them will have very much of it. But one life is a tiny piece in an incredibly large and complex puzzle. Joseph's suffering lasted for a few decades, it is true, but his impact on humanity has been incalculable, and his glory will go on for eternity. When weighing God's larger plan, we find that the trouble believers have in the short term is negligible when compared to the joy we will have in the end and the benefit we will bring to others in the short term. So Joseph tells his brothers not to worry about the past. They will be looking forward, not backward, and in light of their current situation, Joseph explains the next steps. He doesn't want only Benjamin anymore. He wants his father and all of his brothers to come and live in Egypt in an area called Goshen. By having them live near him in Egypt, Joseph can ensure that they all survive the famine. Joseph emphasizes repeatedly that they should go and hurry along back to Canaan to fetch their father and their families. The brothers all share a touching moment of crying and kissing and embracing and spend a while to talk. Surely there's much to catch up on. It seems to me that it might have been an awkward conversation, but I suppose that's speculative. In verses 16 through 17, we hear Pharaoh's reaction to the news, and he is pleased. Pharaoh loves Joseph so much that he takes the attitude that a friend of Joseph's is a friend of his. As such, he offers his full support for the family's reunion. He offers Joseph's family the best land, the best food and goods, and even offers them wagons for transporting themselves and their children back to Egypt. And so it was done just as Pharaoh had ordered, and then some. The brothers were sent back to Canaan with wagons and rich provisions, new clothes, which would be very expensive at the time. Of course, Joseph gives Benjamin the best. 5 new sets of clothes and 300 shekels of silver. The silver alone is worth about 2,000 paper dollars as I speak. Joseph urges the brothers not to quarrel on the way. Quarreling, of course, is something that brothers tend to do, but seeing that they just won the cosmic lottery, getting their brother back and all of the riches of Egypt in the same day, I can imagine that they were prone to jubilation more than to quarreling. On hearing the news that Joseph is alive, Israel is shocked, and at first he refuses to believe it, but he is overcome by the wealth displayed by the brothers, and he decides to go and see his long-lost son. Can you imagine how the conversation with the sons must have gone? I can just picture them coming home. "Hey, Dad, Joseph isn't dead after all. He was sold into slavery in Egypt and eventually became their ruler." To which we can imagine that Israel responds, "Oh, really? Well, you showed me his bloody robe and told me he was dead. So how did his robe end up like that, and how did he get sold into slavery?" There's no good answer for that one, is there? In any case, they decide to go to Egypt. There is one problem with a plan to move to Egypt, however. You might remember that Israel has been promised the land of Canaan, and God himself brought him to that land. To simply pick up and move out of the promised land and into Egypt seems a little morally suspect. Thus, before he moves, Israel offers sacrifices to God, presumably in hopes of finding some direction from him. That plan worked out nicely. God appeared to Israel in his dreams, visions of the night, and in those dreams God told Israel to go down to Egypt, affirming that he himself will go down there with him. So with that resolved, Israel goes and brings all his family with him. Of note, his family includes his sons and daughters, as well as his sons' sons and daughters, but it does not include his daughters' sons and daughters. This is because once his daughters have children, the daughters are married. Thus, they are removed from Israel's family and put into the families of their husbands. Scripture looks at it that way, and regardless of where our culture goes, we will continue to look at it that way. And in verses 8 through 27, we have a genealogy. We will skip that today and cover it next week when we get into some more of the minutiae of these chapters. So Israel came to Goshen, which he and his family were able to find, having sent Judah ahead to get directions from Joseph. And once they had settled in Goshen, Joseph took leave of his duties and went to see them there. It was another emotional reunion with much weeping and embracing. Israel, who has long suffered under the weight of tragically losing his son, says that he is now ready to die, presumably with some measure of peace, since he now knows that his son is alive. Now Joseph has something interesting to say to his family, something which will harken back to last week's discussion, and which will open us up to an important moral and practical lesson. He tells them that if they ever speak to Pharaoh, they should say that they are shepherds. In verse 34, he gives a reason for emphasizing this point. Shepherds, he says, are an abomination to the Egyptians. But how does being an abomination help them? Why would they tell Pharaoh that they are something which Pharaoh considers to be abominable? The answer is that as an abomination to the Egyptians, Joseph's family will be set apart and given a distinct place to live in Goshen. Joseph had already said that the family should stay at Goshen, but Pharaoh must have had it in mind that the family be brought into the royal or priestly class of Egyptian society. If this happened, we would guess that the promised people would eventually be snuffed out. In fully commingling with Egypt, their children would take on an Egyptian character and become more Egyptian than Hebrew. Joseph's plan is to keep the family distinct from the impurities of Egyptian society, and rather than making the Hebrews demand this distinction for themselves, he ensures that the Egyptians will make the distinction for them. Distinction has always been something important for God's people in the book of Genesis. Abraham was called out to be separate from his homeland. Lot was called to be separate from Sodom and Gomorrah. Isaac was separated from his brothers, whom Abraham sent away. Both Isaac and Jacob took wives from their cousins, rather than intermarrying with the Canaanites surrounding them. And in this instance, we have the sons of Israel living separately in the land of Goshen, not mixing themselves with the people of Egypt. They are so eager to be separate that they are willing to be an abomination in order to maintain their distinct identity as God's chosen people. You, if you are a believer, are one of God's chosen people today. And if you intend to receive the blessings of the faith in your lifetime and to help the faith thrive in future generations, you must also learn to be separate. Let's make no mistake here. The culture of the United States, of the broader Anglophone world, and of all Western society has been trending away from faith in God and righteous living for a long time. The West had once been the bastion of Christian belief, and the English-speaking world had long taken the most care in staying true to the Scriptures. Historically, the United States was the leader in showing the world what true faith meant. It is evident, however, that those days are finished. Christianity has been practically outlawed in the public square, and the morals of the state have gone straight into the gutter with travesties like legally protected homosexuality and abortion. And those are just the most obvious examples of very serious underlying problems. The media that surrounds us, movies, music, television shows, and so forth, take every effort to glorify immorality, and when they aren't acting like Christianity doesn't exist, they waste no time in finding new ways to insult and denigrate us. We, as believers, face the same challenge that the sons of Israel faced in this wild culture. Either distinguish yourself from the culture around you, or allow yourself to be consumed by it and to become like it. We have a choice of being separate and being different, or of being submersed and becoming the same. And if we remain wedded to a collapsing culture, we will collapse with it. Right now, many individual Christians and many brick-and-mortar Christian groups have become watered down in their faith because they follow the culture wherever it goes. We don't have to look far for examples. You will find churches with popular songs that have little or no relevance to genuine worship. You will find messages preached which borrow more from popular culture or spiritual self-help books than they do from the Bible. There are many so-called pastors who have given up on preaching morality altogether. They won't tell you what sin is because that would turn some people off to their message. And in making that choice, they have decided to become part of the world by adopting the world's way of life rather than remaining distinct. There are many churches also which have abandoned the teaching of sound doctrine. People won't like us if we tell them that they will go to hell for their sins, but it is true, and so we must warn them whether they like the doctrine or not. But in the minds of some, being liked by the world is of foremost importance. For true believers, there is no fear of being hated by the world, and we believe that it is worthwhile to be an abomination if that is what it takes to be distinct. That's the example we learn from Joseph's brothers, that it is better to maintain your distinct identity and be hated than to give up your essential core and be loved. By being so overly inclusive, many churches have watered down the meaning of Christian to the point that it starts to lose all meaning. If we fail to maintain our core by living in distinction to the world around us, Christian will have no meaning because Christian will look just like everyone else. And if everyone is a Christian, then no one is. And I will reiterate to you one of my sticking points on this. The most essential thing that you can do today to help ensure that believers remain distinct is to take your child out of public schools. It is a requirement for you as a believer in the Bible to raise your children in the fear of Jehovah. If you are giving them to the government to raise and educate them full-time in a secular environment, they will come out of that environment looking more like the world and less like a believer. You simply can't claim to be distinct from a collapsing culture while submersing your children in that culture for 40 hours a week. I think that it is pertinent for us to ask, what has caused the breakdown of American culture in the first place? The answer is obviously complex, but I think that public education is the one culprit above all others that we should look to. When my grandfather was a child, he prayed and received religious instruction as part of his primary education. In 1963, the U.S. Supreme Court put an end to all of that, saying that prayers and religious instruction in public schools were unconstitutional. Now, I agree with that decision. I think that the U.S. Constitution genuinely does forbid the state from leading children in religious worship, and I don't want heretical or otherwise unqualified state employees teaching my children what to believe. The trouble is not that the prayers in school ended, but that Christians had become dependent on the state to provide education. For centuries prior to the establishment of the public school system, the church, not the state, was the center of learning. American Christians coupled up with the state for educational purposes while the state was advancing the Christian religion. But when the state stopped, Christians didn't withdraw. They didn't take back their rightful place as educators, and they didn't ensure that the faith was adequately passed on to the next generation. So when my father was a child, he was not raised with the kind of Christian worldview that my grandfather's generation was raised with. And it was not long after prayers were removed from the schools that American culture began a precipitous decline. There is surely a causal link there. People who are not raised with any real morality or spiritual meaning in their lives will not suddenly begin to live in accordance with the faith when they reach adulthood. So in my mind, the epidemic of immorality and cultural decline is a little like an outbreak of cholera. If you can cut it off at the source, you can put an end to the suffering. Now let's get one thing straight. We don't take the handle off of this pump by bringing prayer back to public schools. I don't want the government teaching religion. The solution is for us to get our kids out of the schools so that they can be distinct from the anti-Christian culture. We should be working tirelessly to ensure that Christian children are educated in their own Goshen, a separate place for Christians, rather than in the halls of Egypt. Even if that makes us an abomination to the culture around us, distinction matters. So please, join me in homeschooling your children or in putting them into a private Christian school. You can help us take the pump handle off and stop the epidemic. The only other option is to remain submersed in the culture and lose your identity. Now we should note that the plan to take Goshen isn't just about remaining distinct by being an abomination. Joseph's brothers will be getting the land for another purpose as well. We will see in chapter 47 that this isn't only about being abominable. Goshen is good grazing land, and since there is little of that available in the famine, indicating that the family is wholly dependent on grazing is the best way for them to get the land. We presume that Egyptians were less dependent on grazing land and more dependent on growing crops for their food. So perhaps that area of Goshen was undeveloped or somehow less suitable for growing crops, but more suitable for shepherds. That brings us around again to the question of why Egyptians hate shepherds so much anyway. Of course, we only really know what the scriptures tell us here. But I did come across another theory on the matter this week, which seems like a possibility. Last week we guessed that sheep might be considered somehow unclean, or perhaps that the Egyptians simply detest the nomadic lifestyle of a shepherd, and I suppose those are still valid possibilities. Another possibility that I ran into is based on a distinct difference between herding sheep and herding cattle. I have no experience with sheep and cows myself, but I am told that sheep will tear up grass by the roots, grazing a piece of land until it is no longer usable. Cows, on the other hand, will eat only the top of the grass and move on to a better location, leaving the first piece of land available for use again once the grass has regrown. So, if the Egyptians are herding cows, they might not like to be around sheep. It is interesting, though, that in Genesis 47:17 we are told that there are at least some flocks in Egypt. Now, for all we know, those are the flocks of the Hebrews, but presuming that they are the flocks of Egyptians, we would suppose that there must be something about Egyptian shepherding that is different from Hebrew shepherding. To that end, there have been a few proposals about what it is that makes Hebrew shepherds abominable. Perhaps the Hebrew shepherds were hated because Hebrews ate their sheep. The Egyptians might have kept sheep for the wool and not eaten them. Some have even suggested that the Egyptians worshipped sheep, and so it would be an abomination to eat them. In any case, in the first six verses of chapter 47, we find Joseph's brothers following his instructions exactly. They appear before Pharaoh and call themselves shepherds. In response, Pharaoh permits them to stay in Goshen and also asks that they look after his cattle there. So the major tension in the life of Joseph is over. Joseph's identity has been revealed and his brothers have come to Egypt. It's a happy ending for everyone. The book of Genesis, which serves primarily as an introduction to Exodus through Deuteronomy, has now accomplished the bulk of its work, as Exodus will tell us how the Israelites got out of Egypt, so Genesis has told us how they got there to begin with. Joseph's story has been one of great tragedy, but more than that, it has been a story of great triumph. Few men sink so low as Joseph sank, and even fewer rise as high as he rose. I would suppose that very few in all of world history have known both extremes. But Joseph's tragedies happened to pave the way for the ultimate triumph and greater good, and Joseph's life was just a small piece in a much larger puzzle that includes even you and me. And finally, Joseph has demonstrated to us this week the need to remain distinctive from the culture around us if we are to survive as a people. Next week, we talk about genealogies, timelines, and other miscellanea.
For those of you who might be listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.